Season 3 opener.
Season 3 opener.
Season 3 opener.
Whoa, I gotta record it. Yo.
You ready? What?
No, I gotta record another song.
You're listening to Tin Can Phone on KBOO Portland. You're listening to the Tin Can Phone Podcast.
3 years in, 3 seasons in, I ain't talking that time. We was stuck in the pen, all the work they kept, all the work put in. Got it out the money, see the dirt on our hands. Pretty boy Poos had a dope plan. The recorder came in when Mike came in, so 10 can't phone with contraband. 9 united, but still convicted, damn, they did our brother wrong. 12 on the yard and he walked that off, now Jaja's when he walk it out. KBOO packed like my cousin's house, but we ain't throwing hands, we talking it out. Bring your own blanket, we at grandma's house. It's Mike, it's Joe, it's Poos, it's me. We was out there yelling, free BG. It's Mike, it's Blue, it's Misfit Queez. But in the cut, that's perfect scene. 10 can't phone, that's something to see. I didn't do it, so I preach in the street, still praising the hood. Like I didn't lose Queef, Moon, Ben, and Billy too. When it comes to the life shit, but I'm cool. So every picture I'm throwing up twos.
Misfit Adi, what's happening? Tin Can Phone, Season 3, premiere. I mean, we back at KBOO. We back in the radio. Man, what's happening? We got my brother, Michael Bernard Stevenson Jr., the artist, the professor, the motherfucking doctor. What's happening, brother?
Queez, thank you. Yeah, always a pleasure. Definitely a pivotal moment, which we're experiencing, but we'll contextualize for the listeners. But in a minute, Blue, how's it going?
Man, I'm good. It's good to be here on Tin Can Phone again in the recording studio and see you guys here and some of the original members of Tin Can Phone up in this piece. So let's do it. Welcome. How's it going, Armand?
It's going good, Blue. Adi, the artist. Buddy with the mustache, man, it feels good to be back. This has been like a 4-year thing.
Yeah. Was it 2018?
Yeah, it was 2018. This has been a journey.
Yeah. No, I'm not gonna lie. Yeah. I just remember when I first came home, I was at the, you feel me, Sub City House, you feel me? And then you had came down, you had some change for me for something we did. It might have been a Great American Story, but you like, I got this money for you, I've been waiting for you. I'm pulling up on you right now. That was hella long ago. That was at the beginning.
So this is an interesting moment for a lot of different reasons. When we're saying 2018, I think we were doing some pre-production, and it was about 2018 that KBOO got involved. Mm-hmm. And so I remember when that was happening, where there's some pre-context, but sitting in the studio now, which is, I mean, we've been in the studio maybe this is our fourth time, but the first ever time was with Armand regarding the era of Great American Stories, and we were here with Aaron Yankee, who had originally, we had gotten an opportunity to have a residency at KBOO, so we were here then, but this project has come a long way since 2018, and it began before 2018, which we'll get into, and we've been referencing throughout the show, but for now, Tammy, you want to give a little shout out to yourself and Aaron as members of KBOO supporting this project?
For sure. Thank you so much. My name is Tammy. I'm currently doing the sound stuff, so I'm kind of like the shadow, the darkness that makes the stars shine.
Okay.
Aaron and a disciple of Aaron's work since she's been around here for, she's like 25 years or something.
Wow.
At KBOO. Still doing a bunch of great stuff. Did Happen Here podcast, that's hers.
Yes.
Yeah, and when I was the public affairs director here, she's like, the show, it's going to start. Just find a time for it on the schedule. So I was like, all right, if Aaron is co-signing on it, it's going to happen.
Awesome. And hey, it happened.
Shout out to Aaron then for the co-sign. She made it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so that history is interesting, but I'll continue to give Tammy a little shout out because if it wasn't for the back end of it getting put on the thing, it wouldn't have been there. did we really need the support. And Tammy's like, I'm on the boards. It's like, last time we were in here, we recorded off the video because we couldn't work the boards. But in this season 3 opener, we will be thanking all of our various contributors. Another thing I want to do, we're going to hop into this recording soon, is so for the guys here, I want to play back the most original recording we have, the first. And it's also really interesting because this was what we presented as our KBOO artist in residence to be working with. And this was kind of what people saw vision in way back then. But this content, since the beginning of Tin Can Phone, has been described as remaining under bondage. So this will be the first time that any of that content has been heard. Let them try to catch us.
You already know.
Hey, Mike, own it. We own it. We
own it. Be an influence.
We own that.
Are you playing something?
I was, but now I'm.
Now this is. Yeah, the levels are a bit. Can we get the levels? Oh, there we go. That's perfect. If we talk like this, this is good. Are we going?
Yeah,
oh, it's recording?
Yeah, I'll just edit it out.
All right, perfect. Well, this is our first interview right now of the Great American Stories, our working title. I'm sitting here with Mr. Irvin Hines. Irvin, hello, Irvin.
How you doing today,
Mr. Irvin? I'm doing good. You want to go by Irv or Smurf? You go by Smurf.
I would like to be known as Irvin, my given name. Smurf is a name that I was recognized with in the streets.
In the streets?
When I was destroying the streets that I grew up in. Smurf was a name that my friends gave me, and because you know, growing up, you don't never use your real name anyway.
No.
So Smurf was something that was given to me by my friends, my close friends.
All right. Yeah. How old are you when you got Smurf?
I was 16 years old.
Okay. Well, yeah. So I wanted to ask you a question here, starting off. We're both from Portland. You're from Portland. What was it like growing up in inner Northeast Portland back in, I guess, the 70s and 80s? Because I'm asking you that question because it's changed so much.
Absolutely.
Since then. I mean, it's one of the only historically black neighborhoods in Portland. And I just kind of want to know your experience growing up there. What was the Northeast Portland like back then?
I grew up in a single-parent home, two younger brothers. And I had an uncle and an aunt who, when we moved, I was born here in Portland at Emmanuel Hospital in 1970. 3 months after I was born, my mom got wind that my father was coming to snatch me away from her from Pennsylvania. And I guess she got pregnant in Pennsylvania and moved down here with my aunt and uncle. So when I was actually born, his threats made her move to California. So I was raised in California until I was 7, and I returned back to Oregon. And coming from that environment at such a young age, it was a sigh of relief at 7 years old because the dilapidation that I grew in the household, it was so dysfunctional, meaning my mom was a bartender. She was a manager of a bar at a young age, and she brought the party home from the bar every night. So I would never get a chance to really see my mom. Only time I saw her was like, you know, as kids they say, be seen, not heard. And my mom would always, when she went to work, was at 4 p.m, she would get off at 3:30, and then whatever party was still going, she would bring it to the house. So I didn't get an opportunity to be raised traditionally by a mother who was showing nurturing, or who had a job, a 9-to-5 job, and then came home specifically to be around the kids. Yeah. I didn't have that. So when I got to Oregon, I remember specifically pulling into the Greyhound station and rain was hitting the window. And you know, it was light out, you could see the headlights of cars and the rain hitting the window, and I was like, rain? I hadn't seen rain like this, you know what I mean? I seen snow one time as a kid growing up, and I'm like, whoa, that says a lot. But then when I actually got to my aunt and uncle's house, who I loved as if they were my parents, and they lived on 6th and Phelan in Northeast Portland, I realized that something new was about to happen in my life, that the constrictment, that having just that one parent now would no longer exist, and that I was able to be who I wanted to be, freer as a child. I didn't have responsibilities to take care of my two younger brothers no more. There were other family members. So the environment that I grew up in Northeast Portland was more like a hardworking type for the adults. Each adult was hardworking, but every house from the left, right, front and back to you were concerned parents, and you didn't have to be their child for them to be concerned for you. If I got caught throwing rocks 10 blocks away from my house, whatever parent caught me throwing the rocks could whoop me and send me on home, and my parent or my aunt or uncle would whoop me again. So there was a familiar atmosphere growing up in Northeast Portland. There was a bond between the working adults that wasn't like it was when I was growing up in California. I was in a household and I was the parent at 7 years old to two younger brothers.
Damn.
That no longer existed when I moved to Portland because my aunts took a lot of that responsibility off of me. They let me be a kid. I wasn't able to be a kid growing up in California.
Did your father stay in Pennsylvania?
He moved here to Oregon. He stayed here in Oregon. He grounded his feet here. He had a sister that was already here. So, and he had family that his mom ended up moving here. I never knew him growing up. I met my dad one time my house that we lived in Portland. My mom got right back into the same business. She was the bartender here. So she had those bartender hours. So she would cook us food and then go to work. So my house became the hangout house with all the kids in the neighborhood.
So that was a little snippet of the first ever recording of the working title Great American Stories, recorded with our special guest and co-founder, Armand. What was it like to hear some of that?
I think it's a trip. I think everyone, most people agree, like they don't like listening to their own voice anyway.
Sure.
And then to like listen to it in the past, it's always a trip. But yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying. This has been a long time coming. Yeah. I think, because that's 2018, it's 2023.
2017, probably.
No,
so you got to think, yeah, it was like 2017 because we did that while I was in there and I came home in 2019, September.
No, yeah, but this is 2017. Yeah,
so that was recorded 2017, 2018, you feel me? But then.
I just think it's so interesting to watch like an idea just go from an idea and then kind of spark and have its own course in life. Yeah. So I think it's beautiful that we're still here and that initial spark is still creating something.
Sure.
I ain't gonna lie, for me, it's like I listen to this, you feel me? Because I have the recording, so I like knowing I can't put it out. I still, because one thing about me is like I always speak what's real in the moment, never made up. So I go back and listen to the interview we did, you feel me? And sometimes it re-schools me, like I have to learn again. And that's when I said, like, I really learned, like, it's just something about the word when you have something down like that. And that's what's special about this, because you got people at, I guess in prison would be considered people's best, the most focused, the most clear that they are. And you get these stories from these guys. And for me, that shit was like homework. I go back and listen to it and be like, damn, I need to get back to this. Like, I need to get back mentally where I was in this space. But like, I don't really tap in with other people's interviews, but I listen to ours a lot and really just, it reground me, you feel me? And I really like check me when I know where I'm messing up or I know how I'm moving. I listen to what I was saying then.
There's so much truth in that, man. And I listen to these interviews too. And I've listened to the Ben Hall one at least 3 times. Yeah. And yeah. I've played that interview for people, bro. And I've had people start crying when they're listening to it. I'm like, what the hell?
My brother.
So it's, I mean, that's the beauty of audio recording, man. It does put like it captures a moment in time so like authentically. And I don't think you can get more authentic than that situation in there.
Hey, you know, it's crazy what I love though. I'm going to let you go right after this, but every intro, I just love how he like, yeah, we ain't even got no name for this, but we gonna like record you and that shit gonna be tight, you down tight. Like, I love that because like, you already know since the beginning, my whole thing been rawness. Like, whatever we do, just make it raw. Don't make nobody be somebody that they not. Let us be authentic. And just that, like, I love that shit. I don't fast forward through that shit. I'm like, you could hear the thing shaking. You could just door opening, closing. Michael, like, come on, go. Like, just talk. It's been recording.
I love hearing that. I think it's like a beautiful validation also of this human's like story, like this idea that you guys put together to really let people come and talk. And I think in prison, people aren't trying to pretend that they're, you know, just like perfect or okay. Like, they're willing to like go into those places talking about family growing up and the difficult things in a real way. I think it's awesome.
But that's why it was special though, because on the yard, all you hear is the tough guy talk and all the tough guy stories. And when he got them in there, you got to really see a glimpse of who these people really was. And yeah, that was special right there.
I mean, there's so many layers because we really have discussed this content in high regard. And producing this show or co-producing this show is also fascinating. I guess I've consumed like 100% of it. Like, I was there every moment. I mean, there's moments that I haven't been around or whatever in your lives or when you all together, but it gets brought into the show. And I'm either here when it's recording or listening to it in post or whatever. And it's so rich, but I then think about like what the listener has access to, which is a small glimpse. So is interesting because we've often referred to this content as being in bondage. And one of the reasons is because the checks and balances of the system. So for those of you listening to Ear Hustle, at the end, when whatever official guy is saying, and I approve this message, you know, we never finalized getting that stamp of approval. So I guess we also like released some contraband just now, but again, come find us. But I mean, I think just the interesting levels is that one of the concerns was that through this content, a victim could become re-traumatized or something.
Yeah.
And maybe a valid concern. However, the content is not that, right? Like, there's not that to find. We're not in danger of accidentally releasing something that shouldn't have been. 100% of the content could be released as is, unedited, and would be fine.
Yeah.
But the other thing that Armand said is we've come so far. So talking about it again as a project, we've had a lot of funding support.
Yeah.
We have a lot of institutional support. We're sitting in an institution now, which I'll also say, as we're recording and releasing near to live, which has never been true for this project. And this content, as we discussed, is several years old. So for that reason, I will also say, anyone hearing the show, we need some funding this year. We don't have, our coffers are empty at the moment. But really, I listen back to our episodes and think about some of the projects we have on the horizon. And this has really become something, you know, and the exploration of the content of the show has really gone much further than the beginning of where it started and what its intentions were as it was developing. It's really gone quite far.
Yeah.
And you all, both production and participant, has created that.
I like hearing this origin of just telling a story, right? I think that when I came on, there was things, contemporary issues that affected people who had been incarcerated that I wanted to talk about, that I wanted to say, how can we shine a spotlight? But there's something beautiful about when you guys are just talking about life or just sharing like experience and being, you know, authentic about like being in a relationship or, you know, connecting or being on the yard and those things that people, you know, just walking around in Portland may never have had an experience with. And it gives that glimpse into it. So I just think it's nice. It gives me some great ideas for where we can travel this year.
Let me see. I don't remember where I was talking about it at, though, but like maybe I was just talking to my brother BG, but how like they had the class, but then like Mike had his own group of people. You feel what I'm saying? Like it was a bunch of the homies who literally didn't sign up for the class, but were always, like we were always be in the hallways and shit, you feel me? Police hella mad, they sitting back. They all mad and shit. Mike out there, I'm telling you, he got the orange beanie, he got the little bag with the thing in it. You feel me? He had the recorder in the beanie, you feel what I'm saying? Like, it's crazy when you just think about like the people that was involved that never really, but they pulled to this though. You feel what I'm saying? Like
right.
They pulled to this and it was damn near like, they down there like looked at Mike like one of us types, like he, what might he do? He just, cause it's too, and then these are the people they consider the troublemakers. These are the people they consider like, they the ones who run this institution type shit. And these the people that's right here, Mike in the middle of it and we all popping it about whatever. You feel what I'm saying? It was just, that was beautiful to me, you feel what I'm saying? And then like seeing Armand, and knowing Armand in passing before this and just really like we always, when we was on the same unit, spoke like what's happening, a little bit of talk, but not really. And then seeing him create that, you feel me? Like, and then they told me like he gonna get a recorder. I'm like, he got a recorder? Like, what you mean? What they got going on over here though? But yeah, it was tight to see Mike in there with the sharks. And it was just, I guess that's just the part that you would never see in the creation of this, or the creation of, they talk about the origin of us being on recording, but just me seeing that, I guess you just won't see that image unless you see the sharks, you feel me? Then you just got Mike in the middle of it with the orange beanie, like.
I mean, listening back, that's actually something that I thought is like, you can't recreate this very easily.
Nah.
At any point, even if we weren't talking about absolutely anything, even if that recorder was just in that room, you can't recreate like the fact of having men institutionalized, no distractions, no phones, no anything, and then just to be in that mindset. Some of us have been in there for years, and then it's just like to go into that type of recording is raw. And especially even we recorded it on a Zoom recorder, so it's not even like individual mics. So it picks up all the background sounds. It picks up all the, you know, the photos Michael was taking or the doors to come, or guards coming in. Like it picked it all up.
And we got fancy too. We got to taking pictures by the whiteboard. All the guests, you feel me? We had to get the pictures with the guests. We was fancy. Mike, you really had us on our shit though. We was fancy.
I mean, it's interesting you say that. I do think in doing this kind of work, which, you know, for those of you listening to the show, maybe is clear or not clear that I'm an artist. I'm introduced that way. And a part of my role, similar to even Ear Hustle, is I was an artist going into the prison. So had different kind of motivations and intentions. But something we were talking about before when you were talking about hanging out with the sharks, so to speak, is I was just actually talking about this yesterday with another socially engaged artist, talking about how important it is to the development of these projects and their sustainability and their health and growth is the depth of the relationships.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I recently, every time my car has Bluetooth and I'll get in, and when you buy an iPhone or whatever, like U2 is preloaded. So then my car's like, are you ready to listen to U2? And I'm like, no. And so I realized I could delete it. I thought it was like hard-coded in there. And I had some of the Great American Stories interviews on my phone because when I was listening back to them and making notes. And so the Irving interview just came on, and I could hear the fiddling with the microphone. And it's funny the way that we talk about it as well, when you were saying it can't be reproduced, because we've lost guys since getting these interviews. Yeah. They've kind of re-entered into the world and become like estranged. I thought it was really interesting, Queez, you were talking about listening back to it, like a meditation.
Yeah.
And so, like Armand brought up, it was such this very specific moment. And it's like, I don't really even know folks inside. So it would take even years of sort of regeneration to try to recreate. And it's interesting, too, because I think there's a recording studio there now. So there's a culture around recording, whatever that is. Yeah. But all that stuff is like, it's this weird, rare gem that occurred in a very specific moment in time. Yeah. And again, with nurturing of the relationships and the content and the mission and the focus have kind of come to the now. Yeah. It's really quite amazing, but it's also interesting how much work everyone has been doing on themselves and growing, and how much the project has been worked on and developed and wants and needs an even greater platform due to trying to understand for myself as an individual participant, collaborator, creator, that the issues, as much as we and as some of this new content we have done or are doing is happening, I'm like, well, we're unique in the world. Mm-hmm. The issue is still rampant, and like we're in a unique position to engage the issue, and the issues remain, you know? So I'm really kind of excited for what kind of potential relationship we can have. We have had, you know, again, now being in our third season, but can have into the future as well.
Yeah.
And to that point, we'll talk about more of our supporters along the way, but also ping pong between contemporary things, which maybe makes sense just to even give a shout out to Gallery Blue. You know, that project, as listeners in the show have learned, that we, you know, did an installation that's now at the parole and probation facility off of 122nd and Market approximately. And when I mentioned, I was thinking when I said unique in the world, Blue and I fought for that project to be what it is. And I guess I should also give a shout out to Rack, who also initially was a foe and became a friend in really allowing this work to be what it can be and is. But yeah, you want to talk about it a little bit?
Well, I talked about Gallery Blue so much, you know, over the couple of years, but we do have a bunch of art from currently and formerly incarcerated artists that is up, and a bunch of work that Michael and I created in collaboration. And just think, a lot of what we're doing, we were trying to change the conversation within the parole and probation office. And I think that that's also a part of what this show is doing. Sometimes we're just talking about life in general, but sometimes we're talking about issues that affect people. And we have a lot of humans that we're advocating for. There's like 15 or 16 men's prisons. There's a woman's prison in Oregon. They just released a thing through OJRC, the Oregon Justice Resource Center, called Death by a Thousand Cuts, which is really similar to something that Armand and y'all were creating, but it's written mostly. But it's information from the lives of these women at Coffee Creek, sort of exposing some of the stuff that's going on. And I think that those sorts of allies and those stories are what people in Portland need to hear and people in the world need to hear. So I think that's the same with Gallery Blue, is the pieces in that are expression from somebody who's had this experience or is having this experience. I guess we don't really ever stop having it, you know? I know the system's not trying to let me out, and I've had my entire sentence vacated. But they're like, no, we love you. Stay with us. Don't go. But I think, yeah, this is going to be interesting to see how we can keep getting the word out. But hopefully Gallery Blue will be open to the public at some point to share it with other people.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because some of this stuff has required negotiations, like with, as we would colloquially say, the police, right? Like, we're literally like.
Colloquially.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because when we did the installation.
I do not approve this message.
Yeah. You say do or do not?
Do not.
Do not approve the police?
Hell no.
Tell us more.
I just don't. POs.
Sure.
Not the police, the POs. Parole officers.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't with them, is what you're saying.
Nah.
Yeah.
No. Not mine.
Yeah. I mean.
Yeah.
No Super Bowl.
Has anyone ever been like, you know what? Like, my brother. I would have. Things would have been a lot worse if I didn't have that just gracious probation officer that helped me out so much. Thank God.
Thanks for all the support.
I was just saying, in the sense of working with them, and I respect what you and Gallery Blue doing, putting the up there. I respect it. I just had to let them know, like, you feel what I'm saying? Yeah. I only respect it, though. Like, yeah. I don't, you feel me? You ain't going to catch the Queez up there putting up no paintings. That's what I'm going to say. You're not going to catch me up there putting up no paintings.
Trust me, we did not think we were going to catch ourselves in there either.
But it's a beautiful thing. You got to have those relationships. Like, if I get in trouble, sure. I'm for surely bringing up 10 Can Phone.
Right.
For sure. Yeah. You feel me? I'm Gallery Blue.
Yeah.
You don't know me.
Yeah, I mean, you're on the wall. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Really funny. Yeah, Mike. There's a whole episode about it.
Mike.
CRCI has a recording studio now. What the f***?
Yeah. That's his people.
Yeah, they do.
That's dope.
All called Awesome, Out of Sight, Out of Mind. But they do other stuff too.
He put them on the stage. He put them on the grand stage. Yeah.
Whenever I think of Gallery Blue, I think of this PO who walked up and she was super supportive of the project, but she's looking at one of the pieces that I did and they all have the words of wrongfully convicted people's stories like pasted into them, right? And she's looking at this, she goes, this is my favorite one. And I'm like, oh really, this is about Steve Biko, you know, who was murdered in prison in South Africa for being a political dissident, for being a patriot, for being a, I don't know if that's the right word, but for being a person speaking out truth for the people. And it was just amazing to have somebody be like, I really like this, you know. It's like, this is a commentary on what you do, you know. And hopefully
now that's
to move
tight,
in a different direction.
Especially when you think about who did the work, it's everybody who been to the, you feel me, the belly of the beast. All that work come from inside and then to shove it in their face. Like, you got to see this every day when you come to work. You got, that's like a better, you feel me, than not, you know what I'm saying? Like,
that's
kind
of part
tight.
Of it, because yeah. During the process, we kind of were getting, we had put some of the work up, yeah. And then one of the POs were just walking around. They're like, oh, not this. We want some different work. And we were like, well, yeah, we were commissioned artists. Like, yeah. You're not a curator. Like, this is not for you to decide. But, like, you know, that. we had to maintain relationships and in a way, like, as the artists, because there was, Rack was the kind of broker and they were the highest say. And they really went to bat for us. Yeah. So Keith and Salvador and originally Peggy. And so it was these folks, when they finally got the mission of this project and they started to do research and to do record a video of us, they said, yeah, I did some research and this doesn't exist anywhere on the planet. There is no incarcerated artist gallery that exists.
Yeah, that's heavy.
And so to me, this is all one effort, right? Yeah. The effort towards abolition.
It's
so
bigger
all
than
of these,
police.
All like, these different things are linked together. Tin Can Phone, Gallery Blue. And so, yeah, I think, and that's why I think it's great to have it on the show. That's why I said, you know, speak up, because they put out a call and they wanted folks who were formerly incarcerated, and we got in by the skin of our teeth, right? Yeah. But there's a whole demographic of folks who don't even want to have a relationship with the institution. Yeah. But having that complicated conversation is important because we are changing the minds of the people with the boot. And so that work is also the work of Tin Can Phone. And so all of this is to say Gallery Blue is just an example of a future project that we have coming up in 2024 that we'll be talking a bunch about. But this is an exhibition that's happening at PICA, who technically was the site of our first ever live recording. Our first episode chronologically was recorded as part of TBA in 2019-20 or something. Yeah. And so that was when we hit the airwaves, so to speak, the Zoom waves. And then that went on KBOO as the first project. And so that was with support of Roya Amir Soleimani, who's a curator over at PICA. And then this year we have an exhibition. Myself and through me, Blue was invited to have an exhibition curated by Nina Amstutz and Cleo Davis. I think the organization's called Forensic Architecture, which is also a big deal, an international organization that's funding this project. And it'll be at PICA, being curated by Kristen, another curator over at PICA. So we're super excited about that. And also, thank you, PICA. And just to shout out, we also have been supported by Oregon Humanities, Southeast Uplift, a Metro Placemaking Grant, and all of this was facilitated by Kirk Rea, who was our fiscal sponsor and is now holding it down over at Afro Village and Abuela's Kitchen. And if anyone
want to put out ahead, there, yeah, like, hit it, baby. These organizations like helped us like in a real way and like as humans like stepped in. These weren't like faceless like, you know, organizations that we had no contact with. And it was like PICA has been this beautiful like ally creating like panels for people to talk about like their either experience as artists behind bars or various other things, just to have organizations like that welcome you back and be like, we want to hear your voice, we want to hear your story, we want to see what you have to offer, has been amazing. Same with Southeast Uplift, like showing up for us in a real way, super awesome.
Yeah, where we are now, season 3 is doing thanks to all of these folks, all of these organizations. So this is a really magical moment and get a chance to thank them on air. And we're going to dial in Kirk to give a short message about his support for the project.
Hello, everyone. Yeah, for a couple years, I worked for a placemaking and community building nonprofit, where in those years, I was able to leverage our institutional status to support Tin Can Phone in getting grants to be able to do various work around the podcast, creating like pamphlet information as well for further community education. And it is an honor working with the team. And in my activist practice, I'm invested in supporting historically marginalized community members, communities themselves, to have a platform to share a voice, as well as to make money. So with these grants, a goal of them was also to be able to pay folks that are producing the show, that are coming onto the show. And yeah, I just appreciate this work of also building relationships and understanding between folks that have been on the inside and then with folks who have only been on the outside.
Sweet. Thanks for joining us and continuing to support us. We're looking forward to continuing to collaborate in the third season. And we have one other very special guest who has been a part of the show since its founding, Buddy Terry, the producer of Tin Can Phone. Whenever we're like, ooh, edit that out, and all of the scritching, scratching, and all the smooth mixing. Yeah. So that's Buddy, and Buddy's going to come on mic and intro himself, as well as share a little bit about another exciting Tin Can Phone related project.
Yep. I wouldn't be without Buddy.
Buddy. Yeah. Well, thanks for giving me a little bit of a platform here. It's interesting to be on mic. You know, I love hearing about this sort of full circle situation because it's something that I've been thinking about a lot given the recent news that I'll mention in a minute, but I got kind of emotional on the way in, honestly, because especially knowing that Armand was going to be here today, because thinking about the full circle picture here, how I got involved with Tin Can Phone it was a roundabout pathway, and we were making some videos about food, basically, on the hunt for the best Portland food cart.
Yeah, we're on the mission for the number one food cart.
That happened at just completely random. And after that, I found out a little bit more about the project and was brought on as the editor. And this was right before the world crashed and burned. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fast forward through that, met Michael. We met at Keys Loaded Kitchen. Shout out to
Keys.
Yeah, absolutely. Just doing the most work up there and serving phenomenal food. And then it's 3 years later now, season 3. And the news really is, I just wrapped up grad school down in the Bay Area, and through Tin Can Phone, found out a fact about Oregon that even as a born and raised Oregonian, I had no knowledge of. It was not on my radar, and that was about Oregon's non-unanimous jury system. And through that was fortunately, you know, able to take advantage of a position of privilege and elevate that issue to a little bit of a wider awareness and a larger platform. And the news really is, there's a short documentary that's coming out in about 8-9 days.
You'll be able to find it when this drops.
It will be available for viewing, not behind a paywall or anything like that, just open viewership. The LA Times has purchased it. And shout out to KBOO for letting us come in here too and record a scene. And we recorded with Takuma Jackson, who is absolutely fantastic human, doing some great work around the Portland area, so kind of keep an eye out for him. And then, yeah, the film has also been accepted into the Global Peace Film Festival in Florida, one of hopefully a few coming up.
And the most recent, I think, cool news is LA Times just actually finalized a partnership with Canon, and Canon will be promoting the film as well.
Very exciting.
But yeah, it's been an absolute honor to be a part of the project and to get to know you all on a deeper level. Like Michael was saying earlier, I think that's really what breathes the heart and soul into this project. And yeah, I'm going to go back behind the camera.
Well, before you disappear, it's also really interesting. I was able to check it out last night because I was like, fuck, we're recording. I should catch on to this. And it's quite good. I mean, I didn't suspect otherwise. It's interesting. My role was more in council than otherwise, but it's really good and really exciting, and it was really interesting to watch it and to see it again, like everything else, an extension of this original mission that started inside, and to really kind of now, as I mentioned earlier, like leverage this platform really to get out there. Maybe some of you even hearing this now found us through that project. And yeah, just want to say thanks for bringing, I mean, there's that, so that's exciting, but also our YouTube is buddy's labor, and hearing us at all is buddy's labor. And so, yeah, to really just thank you for, I keep saying this project, everyone's like, oh, Michael this, Michael that, and I'm like, no one would hear this if buddy was not doing everything else that I just dump audio onto the internet and somehow other people find it. So, yeah, again, thanks for being a part of the team.
Absolutely. Thank you, buddy.
Buddy said something when we were talking, I don't know, a few weeks ago. He just said that if you take the human out of the story, that it lacks something. Like, the documentary is about a person, right? But it's also about this bigger issue. And I think that that's what all this is really about, is like helping people to see, you know, the humanity behind the people who are having these experiences, and also the injustice that is like built into the system. Like, and it's not just one thing. We've had a lot of guests on here that have had unconstitutional convictions, have had wrongful convictions, have had terribly erroneous convictions if you listen to the Adam Gregg thing. So just thank you, buddy, for doing that. I got to go down and see the film in California, so that was super rad and awesome.
Now, I just want to say, like, buddy also was a big piece in, like, making it feel real. You feel me? When you say, like, yeah, we got to pay for this, the editor, and understanding the position he played, I'm just like, because, like, even getting the microphones and getting the headphones, and I remember we were recording, everybody had just got them, you had just gave Blue his on recording, and I just, like, seeing everything develop, and then seeing, like, it's just crazy, because just, again, and I just know he was part of making this feel real for me, you know what I'm saying? Like, sure. Damn. Like, we can't be playing around. Like, he got, you know, this somebody time. This somebody who really going to college, like, doing his shit over there, still traveling, doing all this shit, and still making sure, you know, that he had us. It just really made it kind of real for me, knowing, like, you know, you can't play around this, but I'm going to do that anyway.
I mean, yeah, and for me, I would be like, months would pass, and I'd be like, wait, do we still have episodes? And everybody's like, yeah, I'm taking care of it. I'm like, thank God. Yeah. Oh, my God. So yeah, really, the team is supreme. That being said, back to the documentary and the issue of non-unanimous jury. So in the magic of this project and platform, we're able to stay at the bleeding edge of this issue and how it's resolved. And so it's interesting, when I watched the documentary, it kind of ends on this light-leaning note, like, ah, Oregon. Well, I mean, it's medium. It's bittersweet. It's like, Oregon, they, retroactivity, it's going to happen. And Takuma gets the call, and it's like, we're going to take care of business. The lawyers are going to whoop-de-wop, and bam. And teary-eyed and exciting. And then, you know, it was kind of bittersweet, because it was like, Oregon's doing this for 400 folks. Louisiana is not doing it for 1,500 folks. And so it's got that bittersweet unresolution into the future. But we got some hot takes on it. Blue, do you want to update with how retroactivity is going in Oregon?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give maybe a snapshot.
Well, yeah, you know, it's Tin Can Phone, baby. Yeah. We got an editor.
Down the road. I want to also give Armand some more chance to talk, because it's good to hear him speak. But so where we're at is that, so all these judgments that were unconstitutional, that they knew were unconstitutional, the Supreme Court, and I've quoted this before, said it so offends our sense of judicial fairness that we've overturned it and we're applying it retroactively. But it's like it happened for 95 years. Did it not so offend your sense of judicial fairness for 95 years? Just now you figured it out and the state used that to wrongfully convict people. And so now those, you know, 300 to 400 people have had their sentences vacated. And what it does is it takes them back to the beginning where they have a charge against them. And then the district attorney can make a decision about whether they're going to retry somebody. It doesn't matter whether it happened a year ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago. If somebody's in that situation, now they sit in this like space, this limbo, not knowing what's going to happen. And from what I've heard, the default is for the system. And this isn't going to make sense, right? Well, maybe it will. Somebody could be out, it could be 20 years later, they could be almost done, but the default is to retry. And I don't know how to make sense of it.
Would you have to do the time again? Do they make you retry? Do they like re-time you if that doesn't go anyone's way? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's depending on where each person's at within the context of their sentence. If somebody has 30 years, but they've only done 20, they could give that person, you know, the 10 additional years. Or, and you know how Oregon rolls often, and the criminal justice system in general, is that they will scare people, right? They'll be like, well, originally, we could have given you 300 years. So if you fight for yourself, or if you advocate for yourself, you're just maybe opening yourself up for pain. But, yeah, it's an interesting thing. So I guess we'll see what happens. And this is all through the context of like trying to prosecute less, right? That was part of a foundational principle of the system moving into this new era. Let's prosecute less. Let's try to find ways to have more just outcomes. Yeah. And we only have, you know, in Oregon, we have contractors are the defense attorneys. They don't actually have like a defense attorney department like they do for prosecutors. Yeah. And, they say they have about a third of the public defenders that they need to really meet everybody's needs. Yeah. And they're kicking people out with new charges. They're just like, all right, we can't try this person. They're letting people go. But with this stuff, with the non-unanimous jury and with Measure 11 things, they're digging in. So I guess we'll see how it all manifests. You never know what's going to happen until it happens. So I still hold out hope. I think Armand and I were talking about this like optimism that won't die. I don't know if you share that, Queez, but it's like, just keep on rolling, thinking, hey, everything's probably going to work out eventually, you know? It's like, wait a second, I've taken like 99 hits, but maybe the next one, it's going to work.
You
got to
be like
out.
That, though, yeah. Mav, because then that means you know you're willing to fold. You hear me? The old saying, no matter how many times you fall, you just got to get back up and shit like that. Hey, it's a saying they always say, a lot of people don't like it. Nah, never mind.
Where are you going with that? Nah,
you know, it's a saying, pick yourself up by your bootstraps.
Yeah.
I be telling you, hey, people don't like that, though. Especially like in my community. You feel what I'm saying?
No, but I'm.
I think it's funny.
But I think we have talked about that. And I think just in life in general, no matter if you're United States 2023, if you're decades in a war in some other country, it's like, I think in general, just to be optimistic is probably the better hand for life. I don't know. That's what I choose. I try to choose that. Even on the dark times, you got to try to look for something that's positive. Yeah. You have to. Or what? You just give up and fold?
Because once you realize certain things, what you thought or how it looked or what you wanted to be, it'd be easy to fold. Keep on striving. What I do think, though, about the non-unanimous jury, though, is like, I just feel like if it came to a point where you know y'all did something scandalous, it shouldn't be no retrial. You feel me? Like, just let me go, man. Like, we don't need to retry. You cheated me in the first one. You think I want to go back to trial? You cheated in the first one.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting. I mean, it was interesting because ruminating on after watching the documentary, you know, in preservation of the institution of law, it doesn't matter. You committed a crime. You served all of your time. But the necessity to prove that the court was right the first time. But like you said, it went through the process and the judicial system did something injudicious or
the trying law to think. Broke the law.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so in the attempt to correct the law, they get to reinforce the law. It feels like double jeopardy.
Boom.
And outside of the statute of limitations. So yeah.
You know,
things don't apply.
Well, it's probably also too to make it so the state hasn't doesn't have to compensate anyone for their time that they've taken away. You know what I mean? That seems like, again, I'm not a legal advisor, but it seems like there's probably room for some civil suits on that.
Nah, for sure. But if it came down to it, though, like, I don't even want the money. Just let me go, man.
Yeah.
You could just let me go. As long as it ain't been, like, no dub or nothing. But I just, I feel because it sounds good when, like, we're going to pass this and they recognize it, but then that's the only part that's highlighted, especially like in the news and shit. That's the only part that's highlighted. So knowing somebody that's going through it and knowing like, oh, they did pass this, but you still kind of like, you just fighting the case again. Like, that's like, I don't know. I just feel like things like that, when it's on them, they should just let you go, give you a couple dollars or something. If not, just let you go. No parole, probation, no retrial, no none of that. Just let me go.
Just give my life back.
Just give my life back. Y'all messed up. Y'all clearly the only people that cheat if you losing. I ain't never seen somebody winning and then cheat while they already winning. You losing, right. So you cheated. It's over.
They want to dig in, right? The system digs in. It's you guys know the Central Park Five, where like their whole thing gets overturned. They have the actual person who committed the crime, and the AG is like, I still think they did it. It's like, what do you mean? You have the actual person who did this crime. It's this, I don't know, like Michael said, it's trying to reinforce like the justice, right? The rightness of the system. And we all know is false. Like, just let it go. Like,
side note though, I really don't like officers that like be a part of shit like that. And then like all these years later, they be like, I'm sorry, I did this all these years ago and she made me or he made. Like, you feel me? Like, it's like hella cops that be part of these scams. You feel me? And then, like, they get a bad conscience or something, be like, I'm so sorry. You wasn't, I don't know. You just mentioned the Central Park Five, and I remember, like, some of the cops being apologetic. I'm like, man, you feel me? That's why I be feeling the way I be feeling sometimes. I just hate the apology. Like, you did that. Just stand on it. Stand on it. You did it. You like.
I mean, it's interesting. Someone who finds themselves in that moment, at least in that moment, they're not someone full of integrity. And maybe that journey, maybe they then are full of integrity at some point. You know, maybe. But it doesn't, you know, this is kind of unrelated, but overlapping. Someone mentioned to me that one of the things that are so challenging about, like, a crime that has trauma for a victim is that the victim didn't choose the experience, and then they have to choose to heal themselves. And there's a lot of energy that goes into doing that. And so that also occurs for folks who are in prison. So on that Irving recording, it goes on to talk about how he was wrongfully committed or wrongfully accused of a murder and, you know, got off because a juror went out of their way to tell the truth about the matter. But the damage that it continued to do in his life, and also is quite interesting because that I was listening back to these recordings and they seem super relevant to use for this exhibition that's coming up, which will also have audio components, which is also interesting because Irving really set the stage at being born at Emmanuel Hospital in 1970. And so, you know, like all of those things are really setting the stage for this city and the, like what's happening and how it actually has an impact. And so one of the things that this project does is take these disparate stories and kind of philosophize them and marry them right to the context. So I'm excited for all of those things to kind of transpire. But it's what this exhibition is about and what we're kind of talking about now is the ways in which governance and policing unfairly stacks the deck in their favor and the kind of the depth of the negative impact that it has on the lives and communities beyond. And it's really interesting to kind of bring those things together. Of course, I was thinking about this and I can't remember the specific examples, but, you know, we're talking about non-unanimous jury and, you know, wrongful conviction, tying you up in court, keeping you on parole, and all of these different systems that are working together without saying they are. I think I was thinking about how, like, the decriminalization of different drugs and narcotics in Oregon. And so I was like, oh, this is good. But at the same time, there's been no fiscal investment in treatment centers. And they're also taking houseless camps and they're making day camping illegal. And so they're creating all of these other laws in which to continue to police and enforce. And in, again, the Irving interview, he talks about family from Vanport and them surviving that right? So they're keeping everyone on their heels for generations. Yes, the Vanport flood and the displacement there. So all of this stuff is linked, and this is a really amazing platform where we're linking them together. Like, I get exposed to some of this stuff in a vacuum. I'll learn some stuff about the Vanport flood. I'll learn some stuff about some communities and families. I'll learn some stuff about a neighborhood. But this project really links these things together, and this exhibition we're doing, it's going to be a map of King, Tubman, Jefferson, CRCI, and the Cottonwood School, which is near an ICE center, which is where they used tear gas when the protests were happening, and they essentially poisoned the soil of an elementary school. And so it's going to link all these ideas together about how we are systematically creating a poisoned platform in which for certain people to grow up and develop, and then policing occurs for certain people on a certain level and degree and level of fairness, and then even what happens after prison. So, yeah.
Hey, ain't he running for mayor?
Who?
Urban Hines.
Oh, yeah, I was supposed to be right.
He was running for mayor, wasn't he?
Yeah, I believe so.
That was in the recording.
Shouts out, bruh.
So all that being said, both we have in the studio, and maybe even for the video you want to model it, we got two Queezes as an entrepreneur.
We got two Queez original shirts on.
We got the Gilded.
For those that are listening to the audio experience, Queez is rocking the Trauma Almost One, the beat up little bear. It's glowing. Mm-hmm. He has the matching hat and pants with him, and the shoes. It is a little bit of a fashion show right now. And I also have a Queezati original shirt on. Too real to be famous shirt.
My boy's most definitely too real.
Pre-ordered it, got it in.
Yeah. Photo shoot fresh. We fucking around, man. I'm not gonna lie, I love it.
So Queez the entrepreneur, what's going on? This is season 3 opener. You know, where are you at these days?
Yeah, I'm jugging. I'm back in that mode. Like I said, like it was a lot of stuff going on, and I was just going through the roller coaster, right? So especially if I'm saying Trauma Almost One is life, you feel what I'm saying? Like when I'm not going through and I'm not doing what I feel is the best for me, and like I always say, you never know who watching, you never know who listening. Be careful with the message you deliver. You feel what I'm saying? So going through what I was going through, I couldn't really tap in and deliver no message because it might not have been the right one, because I was making decisions at a point where it was just like day for day type shit. Like we finna live for now, I gotta just figure out, because I always struggle with, especially, you know, I'm a repeat offender, you feel what I'm saying? I done went back hella fast, you feel what I'm saying? So that messed me up psychologically. It made me start questioning my decision making. If I could go do all this time, 7 years, you feel me, get out and go right back in a month, 2 months, you feel me, and then do a whole nother three, you feel what I'm, you get what I'm saying? Like it kind of messed my decision making up. And then hearing the stories, hearing, like, it's a lot of people that mess with me, you feel what I'm saying? But, like, when you start peeping the reason they mess with you, all my stories was super, you feel what I'm saying? So I started seeing, like, okay, I'm going back down, so let me start making decisions for me and not worry so much about society, like, oh, this is what it looked like in society eyes, or this is what it looked like, this is what, you feel what I'm saying, getting lost in the internet, you feel me? A lot of shit, like, a lot of people run to the internet and want to post and, you feel me, try to like gain the attention or gain the side of certain figures, you feel me? I couldn't do the internet thing, so like a lot of the things I was going through, I had to just do internally, and then like making sure like my kids still see me, you feel what I'm saying? So this is, I'm dealing with this shit in real life, and then my brother being back in jail, and like I'm having to put money on his books, money on his phone, I gotta, you feel me, three-way his girl, and I'm trying to keep his relationship cool to make sure if he do go upstate, because he talking fed, this is feds, this ain't state, he playing a different ball game. Internally, though, that I don't got nobody to reach out to, I don't got nobody I'm going to fall back on, I don't got to, you feel what I'm saying? So I'm dealing with all this and still trying to, like, make sure I make the right decision, still pushing Trauma Almost One. And this is why it's so important, because I have to fix my mood, I have to fix my mind, I have to make sure that, because you never know who watching. There's some people who hit me like, bro, what's up? Like, you know, I fucked your videos, bro, like, sometimes I'd be having to really go check you out. You be talking that shit, you feel me? And with that, I'd be like, okay, like, shake whatever the bug is. And like I said, listening to our recording, it is therapy, because I go back and I'm like, man, like, sometimes I have to go back and, like, the answers be right there. I've already did this video 2 weeks ago, not knowing that I'm going to be going through this today. So it's just, it's a beautiful thing. And just understanding my gift, you feel me? Understanding, like, the power of the word. understanding, you know, the agreements, you know, whatever somebody call you, you ain't gotta, you know, if it ain't what you answer to or if it ain't what the name your people call you that you answer to, it don't matter what they call you, you feel me? And just like I always was big on that, being a repeat offender, like my whole life, 11, 12 years old, I got mug shots, you feel me? Like child of the system for real. So when you constantly in the system and you constantly, like, before it was like, okay, I'm gonna take the risk, I'm gonna feed the fam, I'm gonna do whatever it takes to, you already know how I'm rocking. But then when it's like, I was just talking to bro the other day, I'm like, damn, I remember when I first came home, I was looking at that post from that day, and all the posts were like, don't go back, don't, family members, don't, you know, some people was like, congratulations, you home, this, this, and that, but a lot of the messages was, don't go back, don't, I'm like, damn, like, But if you wearing Trauma Almost Won, but you engaging in, you feel what I'm saying, it's like a crowd, like, I don't want you really wearing this, engaging in that. Because the message behind this, I am Trauma Almost Won, so Trauma Almost Won is bigger than a t-shirt. So it's kind of like even just being careful with, like, let me make you some shit personally, like, without you having to. It's not just about the money.
Sure. I mean, I think that's really interesting, as we have on various instances trying to cultivate your various enterprises, and hopefully those things kind of take off with everything else we're working on. I think what you're saying is really interesting, partially because, again, thinking about it from the avenue I'm thinking about it, it's probably possible to get funding, like, because it's not a for-profit idea and it also has, like, medicinal qualities.
Yeah.
You can get the project funded as a art project, so to speak, and that allows you to just give it away as opposed to trying to, needing to have the way that it lives by people buying into it.
Yep.
You're getting funders to fund the project and you're able to dispense it in the places where it will most be well suited. But that's what makes it interesting, right? I mean, I don't know that I was thinking about it that much. I mean, and Too Real to Be Famous had this kind of, I mean, even to just see your transition when you're talking about rap, like, you know what, and it was really interesting, and I think, like, the intros are really wonderful because they, and on the special Juneteenth episode that we did on KBOO, you know, there was all of this of your kind of poetry in what you're experiencing, and I think it's more powerful. Like, it was really funny in season one when all you guys were, like, super hard, and you were like, let's talk about drugs inside, like, let's talk about contraband, let's talk about fighting, let's prison. But it was, it's interesting, too, in the evolution of this show, because you guys were, like, recently traumatized by that. Yeah. Like, that's really what was going on and what you knew and what you needed to process, and the show was there for that. But as you all kind of grow and change and evolve and move forward, this platform is also growing with you and is there for that. And even its origins are able to come back to and ways to guide you in the present. But it's really exciting that also your brand and how you're moving through the world, you're like, this isn't for everyone. It's only for folks who are kind of like doing the work, right? And it's also a kind of a beacon in which to bring others toward doing it.
I'm not putting it in a box, because I'm just saying, like, it is for everyone if you're there mentally. You know, so I'm just like, if you know the message of Trauma Almost Won, don't just look at the art and the design of them like, oh, yeah, I'm going to wear that, but I'm going to be over here in the school zone selling work.
Right.
Like, come on, bro. It's just the representation. And that's why I say it's more important than money in a sense of, you know, if you're really doing the right thing, are you pushing the right way? Or if you're not, it just be careful of, because you never know who's watching.
Sure.
You get what I'm saying? And I don't want to take something that means so much and then just be like, okay, just because you got the right money, huh? Go take it in.
Of course. As you all well know, in the room, we have a very special season 3 opener. It's going to be a 2-parter. So those of you listening on the airwaves, make sure to catch us again soon. And we'll segue into some new topics then, which we'll do a rough close. Thanks, y'all. Goodbye.
That was wild. Misfit Adi, this is Tin Can Phone. Hey, man, this is the season opener. We gonna catch y'all. Y'all know what I'm talking about, man. You got the gang in this month. The boys is back in town. Armand, you feel me?
We got Armand here, you know, and then we also have the artist.
Deep voice.
The artist.
That's me, and I'm here with Blue, and we are cutting
this sucker. We got photo shoot fresh Blue.
Off.
You're listening to the Tin Can Phone Podcast on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, Season 3. You can find us on the first Tuesday of every month. Tune in at KBOO.FM or on 90.7 FM.